Welcome to a new Action for Happiness podcast, and as always, I'm your host, Guy. On today's episode, we have the pleasure of speaking again with Claire Kelly of the Mindfulness in Schools project. So if you want to teach young people mindfulness, you've got to understand it from the inside out. The Mindfulness in Schools project helps schools and youth organisations to develop mindfulness initiatives. And Claire's role is to develop classroom-friendly materials and to train teachers to deliver them. We get into the struggle of mass implementation, the Myriad project, one of the largest mindfulness research projects in education. We talk about the 5,000 teachers trained, 500,000 children reached, the randomized control involving 8,000 students, and the big question, does mindfulness help with exam results?
Brexit was filtering through in terms of anxiety about what happens next, you know, post-Brexit. And now the coronavirus, I think I get a sense that there's this residual collective anxiety that everybody is picking up, but especially young people, you know, because they're really worried about the future. Executive function seems to consistently be something that's affected by practicing mindfulness. And by executive function, we mean all those essential skills like making choices, controlling, you know, having a sense of control over what you're doing with your mind, concentration, pulling apart questions, analysing, all of that stuff is potentially affected by mindfulness, but early days in terms of the research. And then later, what's interesting is that we're noticing longer term impacts. So having been around for 10 years, we're getting kids who did it 8-9 years ago coming back to their teachers and going, I didn't think I'd taken any of that in. And I used this particular practice last week.
Yes.
You know, we all remember the teachers at school who were engaged with us and we felt heard by and listened to and enjoyed being with, and the ones that we really didn't. And it seemed that's still the case when you're teaching mindfulness in a school's context as well.
Action for Happiness is a movement of people committed to building a happier and more caring society. You can join thousands of others who are spreading a bit more happiness in their homes, workplaces, schools and local communities. You can join thousands of others who are spreading a bit more happiness in their homes, workplaces, schools and local communities. Our website has all the information you need to sign up for our Exploring What Matters course, and also details about facilitating one yourself. All the information is online and we're here to answer any questions. Don't forget to subscribe, like, and follow to keep up to date with all our content. Find out more at actionforhappiness.org. Join the movement, be the change. All right, so Claire, thank you so much for jumping in and doing this again. It's actually your third time with us.
Is it really? Blind.
Yeah, on the Action for Happiness podcast.
You're not bored of me yet.
No, we love having you back. Our first in 2014. We spoke again in 2016, so it's five, six years relationship there. So, you know, mega excited to have you back, but also given, you know, your work with Mindful in Schools project and your role, it's really cool just to kind of keep up to date with the evolution and what's going on and, you know, revisit some of the topics we spoke about on the last podcast and to say, well, where are we now?
Yeah.
And cool. So it's, you know, really awesome having you back.
And you've had a baby since the last speech.
I've had two.
Two babies. That was quick work.
You got two as well, right?
I have. Well remembered. That's incredible. Yeah. You look really well, considering.
Yes. Well, I've got hair since the last time we spoke as well.
Yeah. No. You've grown some, or you've acquired some from somewhere. It's good. It's good hair.
Yes.
It's good.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Getting a bit white on the sides and
on
the top.
Nah. You don't know the half of it. Just you.
So why don't we set the scene for listeners that haven't tuned in to, you know, the previous conversations that we've had. Obviously, Mindfulness in Schools project kind of gives it away in the name as to what it is, but perhaps, you know, and perhaps if you could share with us, you know, what is the Mindfulness in Schools project, and also, you know, what is your role and involvement in that, and let's begin there.
Yeah. Okay. Mindfulness in Schools project is a charity. We've been going for about 10 years now, and our main role is to help schools and other youth-based organisations to develop mindfulness initiatives in their workplace, in their school context. And we do that through creating materials that are very kind of classroom friendly, although they have been used in lots of other contexts as well. And then we train teachers and people working with young people to deliver them. But always with a key prerequisite, which is, you know, you've got to walk the talk. It's not like other teaching. It's interesting working in an educational context. The culture is very much, you know, go on a training course, learn how to do something, pass it around to all your friends, and you can all teach it. And that really isn't what we do in terms of mindfulness. We've got all kinds of lovely resources people can use, but we just say, if you want to teach young people mindfulness, you've got to be doing it yourself. You've got to understand it from the inside out. Mm-hmm. So my role within Mindfulness and Skills Project is to help develop those materials and to train people to teach them. And I also oversee the training teams, our trainers as well.
So when you see the volume of research when you see the research that comes in, you know, at a high pace, you know, is it up to you to keep sifting through it and finding out what's new and updating and editing your content in line with the new research and findings?
Yeah, exactly. We've got to be very on the ball about what's coming out. I mean, from a mindfulness point of view, it's a very exciting time to be involved because obviously there's all kinds of wonderful research coming out. Some of it is kind of, how can I phrase it, helpfully critical. And I think that's really important that we're constantly checking in with what we're doing, going, well, does this work? You know, is this appropriate? But kind of key areas where we've had to kind of really start to rethink what we do are, they include things like trauma. You know, there's great work going on around trauma generally and helping to support people and treat people who've experienced trauma. But very specifically within the mindfulness world, there's a growing understanding that we might have to change how we approach it slightly when you're dealing with people who've had traumatic experiences. Mm-hmm. And when you're working with large groups of young people, and indeed actually the people who work with them, because we train them as well and hopefully keep them as well as it's possible to be, the chances are you're going to have somebody who has either experienced severe trauma or, you know, they talk about trauma with a big T and trauma with a small T, and nearly everybody's experienced some kind of traumatic event in their lives, whether it's a massive life-changing event or something that's just really there at the back of your mind and might pop up to kind of revisit you when you least expect it. So that's an area that we're really working on now, is how to build in more trauma-sensitive approaches in what we do.
And when you say trauma, does that include bullying as well, or are you referring to something more external to the school?
It can be all kinds of things.
Yeah,
it can be all kinds of things. It can be, you know, somebody, for example, who's experienced a massive accident, or a member of their family has died very suddenly, or you know, maybe lots of schools are working with kind of students who are coming from refugee families, who, you know, have experienced all kinds of terrible things. And that would be trauma with a big T. Mm-hmm. But you might also have young people who've experienced bullying, or something really unpleasant happened to them online, or, I don't know, maybe, you know, separation in a family. All of that can land in such a way that it has ongoing consequences for that young person.
Yeah, and if we... You know, if we look at the mad media coverage of the coronavirus, and I saw that, you know, what you sent me, the mindfulness in schools, you know, you've had a guidance on how to wash hands and for sanitary. So, you know, what inspired that? And, you know, when we're speaking of trauma and, you know, global events, these young students, these young children are being exposed to it. They pick up the newspaper, they pick up their phones, alerts. It's literally it's a buzzword. It's coming in all the time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we're converts, but there's never been a better time to be practicing mindfulness. Because even before coronavirus, you know, there's the whole, that residual anxiety in everybody's mind, especially young people, about the future. You know, where are we going? What's happening to the environment? Brexit was filtering through in terms of anxiety about what happens next you know, post-Brexit. And now the coronavirus, I think I get a sense that there's this residual collective anxiety that everybody is picking up, but especially young people, you know, because they're really worried about the future. Their future, their family's future, the country's future. So the hand washing, actually, it came out of a team meeting we were having earlier on this week, which is, you know, here we are giving all this guidance out. We're sending out guidance to people coming on courses with us and to our trainers. And actually, there is a brilliant opportunity available when you're washing hands to just stop and pause and with your mind manically rushing around, worrying, anticipating, planning, ruminating, whatever it might be. And it does that naturally, let alone when we're in the middle of a massive pandemic. Mm-hmm. Washing your hands is a brilliant opportunity to just really bring full awareness to what's happening right now, rather than something that might happen in the future or has happened already. So we've sent a little bit of guidance out about those people who don't know much about mindfulness or have never mindfully engaged in an everyday activity. There's a little bit of guidance there on how you do it. A little pause in the midst of everything else going on.
Yeah, I can't really remember the last time I paused when I washed my hands. You know, we do a business and then we head to the sink, wash our hands and we leave. So, you know, to completely change our relationship to hand washing is a pretty cool, you know. Yeah, well, I like that idea.
Well, just also, you know, any everyday activity you're doing. And I've really loved exploring is what you do before you start emailing. You know, I spend a lot of my day at a computer communicating with people or developing content, and it's very easy to go diving straight into that without any kind of moment for kind of pausing or reflecting. And actually, even before you pick up a phone to answer a call, there is an opportunity there, even if it's just for a few seconds, to just ground yourself before you carry on. Mm-hmm. And I think it just makes such a difference to the quality of your experience and potentially how reactive or responsive you are in relation to whatever it is that you're then dealing with. Mm-hmm. We should be doing more of that. You know, to do mindfulness, you don't have to be constantly sitting down for, you know, 30, 40, 50 minutes at a time doing a formal practice. It's there all the time. Mm-hmm. I think some of us do it already. We probably don't even, not even aware that we're doing it. But the more we can build it into our day, that's when you see the real change, I think.
Yeah. And as John Kabat-Zinn says, you know, life is the meditation. You know, the formal practice is a big part of it. But it's actually, you know, how you're living your day. That is the meditation.
Absolutely, you know, right.
Yeah, how often can you be mindful?
That's right. Absolutely right.
So let's talk about the input in the impact report that the Mindfulness in Schools project released last, so the 2018-19 year. And first of all, is that something that we can share with the public?
Yeah, it's out there. Yeah? It's publicly available.
So I'll put a link to it. And it's a really great insight as to, you know, how far you guys have come along. And just to, you know, quote some of the facts and figures. So since 2009, you know, over 5,000 teachers trained.
Yeah.
Which is huge. And just, you know, last year alone, so the 2018-19, you know, 591. So just under 600 teachers trained.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, talk about when we hear figures like that, it's like, wow, these are great numbers.
Yeah.
You know, especially if, you know, I'm coming from a place where I believe that, you know, mindfulness should be part of the curriculum, the educational curriculum. Mm. And it's very encouraging to see these statistics and these figures. So, you know, so how's that going along? What's the reaction to it? And, you know, what are some of the results now?
It's amazing. So, oh gosh, there's so much I could talk about. We probably don't have 4 hours. So in a culture at the moment, what we've really noticed is that mindfulness is kind of out there. Everybody's pretty much heard of it now, which is a big change even to kind of 5 years ago. Schools are very focused on mental health and well-being, quite rightly, and there's government guidance on the fact that that should be the case. So what we're offering is actually landing quite well for schools. The key issue really is, you know, we're training lots of teachers, but in the overall context of how many schools there are out there and how many teachers there are out there, it's actually just a drop in the ocean. Mm-hmm. What we don't want to do, it's interesting hearing you talk about having mindfulness on the national curriculum. That would be lovely if everybody who is teaching it was well-trained and wanted to teach it. But what tends to happen when things are made compulsory is that schools who are already overstretched in terms of staffing and so on will grab a teacher who happens to be free at that time that week. And that teacher will then teach those sessions. And they won't necessarily do it well, and they won't necessarily understand what's involved, and they won't be practicing necessarily. So I think we've got to be careful about how ambitious we are in terms of making something compulsory or part of the national curriculum. If we could get to a point where every teacher, as part of their training, their teacher training, had an opportunity to practice and learn some mindfulness, I think that would be a game changer. Yeah. Because it's not just going in and teaching mindfulness to the kids, it's being mindful as you teach. It's being more tuned in to what they're saying and less reactive around what's happening in the classroom and modelling what it is to be an adult. And at the moment, you know, kids are in classrooms seeing teachers exhausted, stressed, burning out, and that's what they understand adulthood to be. So that's what they'll go forward with, you know. How did I get onto that? I'm going off on one here. So yeah, 5,000 teachers is fantastic. And we're estimating that means about 500,000 kids have had some kind of training based on our curricula. But we've got a campaign going called A Million Minds Matter. We want to reach a million minds in the next 5 years. But still through good training, you know, still through doing it properly. Because it's more sustainable that way. There's lots of schools out there who want to do some mindfulness and they don't have any money or time. And so with the best heart and the best will in the world, they'll grab any resources they can and have a go. And sometimes that's lovely. Sometimes it's, you know, a bit of mindful colouring in. and sometimes it's not done so well. And we've also heard tales about that too. So we've got to find a way to make training accessible in a very stretched economic environment, and then, you know, make sure it's done well so that it's sustainable, not just a flash in the pan.
You're listening to the Action for Happiness podcast. My name's Guy, and on today's episode, we're joined by mindfulness in schools teacher and content creator, Claire Kelly. In the second part, we talk about exam results and about the largest mindfulness in education and myriad research project.
What are some of the benefits that... You know, and I understand that it's not just the students, it's not just the teachers, but it's the parents, it's the whole school, it has a wider reaching effect. So perhaps you can touch upon that.
Yeah. Well, the feedback we kind of encourage research. We don't conduct the research ourselves, but we encourage it and we support research where we can. So a lot of the research we're getting back is from small classroom based what they'd call action research. That includes impact reports. So at the end of a course, the teacher who's taught it, whether it's our primary school course or our secondary school course, we've now got something called Dot Breathe, which is for kids who are moving between primary and secondary. And we've also got an early years curriculum coming along so that the kids and the teacher will fill out a questionnaire having completed the course. So we've got about 6,000 students on our primary school curriculum impact report. And we've got... off the top of my head, I can't remember. It's probably about 9,000 students on the Dot B1, the secondary school. The consistent feedback is they use it regularly. They tend to use it when they're really up against it. So it will be, you know, before they go into a test, when they're worrying at night and they're not sleeping well, when they are trying to really concentrate. They use it in sport a lot. They use it for kind of performing, standing up in assemblies. And then later, what's interesting is that we're noticing longer term impact. So having been around for 10 years, we're getting kids who did it 8-9 years ago coming back to their teachers and going, I didn't think I'd taken any of that in. Mm-hmm. And I used this particular practice last week because I needed to.
The seed was planted.
The seed was planted. Exactly that. We're planting seeds, you know, some of them will bloom immediately and some of them won't. So the impact from our point of view and at our end is around that kind of feedback. The teachers are really enjoying teaching it. They're noticing a shift in dynamic in the classroom. The classrooms tend to be a little bit calmer. The conversations are richer within the classroom. Mm-hmm. The kids, this kind of backs up what we've found already in general research around mindfulness. The ones that need it the most seem to benefit the most. Mm-hmm. So those kids who are having difficulty, emotional difficulty, behavioral difficulty, are the ones that are really showing the benefits. Things like, you know, young people with ADHD, kids who are really struggling with behavioral issues, that's where we're also seeing lots of impact. I should also mention, you know, there is a massive research study heading our way. I don't know if you've heard of it, Myriad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was my next question. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, the three phases we spoke of last time.
Yeah. So Myriad's kind of drawing to a conclusion this year. Massive research project headed up by Oxford University, but lots of other universities involved as well, including UCL, King's, London, Cambridge. And they're looking at mindfulness from lots of different perspectives, four key themes. So looking at the best way to train teachers to deliver it, the best way to roll it out in schools and to see what potential benefits it has for both the staff who've had to learn mindfulness and then the kids who've had the Dot B course. And then, you know, about implementing it, what's the most effective way of implementing it in schools. Mm-hmm. But the biggie is the big randomized control trial, which involves about 8,000 students and about 250 teachers. So the results of that are coming out possibly later this year, possibly next year. And I think, everyone's getting very excited about it. I think we have to kind of stay calm. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that's definitely coming up out of that is the importance of mindfulness being taught well. And the qualities of the teacher in the classroom and how they relate to the students. So it's not just about practicing mindfulness and then being trained to teach it. It's also about how you are as you teach it, how you're teaching it.
Yes.
We all remember the teachers at school who were engaged with us and we felt heard by and listened to and enjoyed being with, and the ones that we really didn't. And it seemed that's still the case when you're teaching mindfulness in a school's context as well.
Well, what about exam results? You know, has there any correlation between, you know, those, you know, two independent groups, one that does mindfulness, one that doesn't, and, you know, in the same year, same environment, same teachers, but then, you know, exam results. Is there anything, because, I mean, I guess that's the biggie, you know.
There's a biggie for schools.
You know, how much of an impact, if any, if you added an element of mindfulness.
Yeah. Right,
because you got the science, creativity, memory, concentration, you know, classroom citizenship, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I mean, it's early days. There is research coming out about the link between mindfulness and academic attainment. Really hard to kind of pull it apart there and go, oh, all right, definitely mindfulness caused them to get, you know, 14 extra marks in their GCSE exam. In biology, I don't think that's ever going
to. Let's go back to your example about, you know, outside the nightclub. But what about, you know, you go to sit your GCSEs and the first question is like, I have no idea how to do this.
Yeah.
But can you then, you know, the heartbeat raises and the panic mode, or what if I don't get into a good uni? And so you, what if you can, you know, why let your response to question one affect how you answer question two?
Absolutely.
And question three and question four and question five, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so. And it's interesting hearing you talk about sort of executive cognition, memory and so on. The research that we're getting, I'll answer your query about that kind of stress thing in a minute. Executive function seems to consistently be something that's affected by practicing mindfulness. And by executive function, we mean all those essential skills like making choices, controlling, you know, having a sense of control over what you're doing with your mind, concentration, pulling apart questions, analyzing, all of that stuff is potentially affected by mindfulness, but early days in terms of the research. In terms of managing things like the stress of exams, 100% no question. I'm not aware of any large scale studies involving this, but all the time we get people talking to us about how the kids say it helps me with exams, it helps me calm down. Panicked in an exam and I did this practice and I suddenly could answer the question. And I had my own experience of it when I was teaching in schools. Stop me if I've told you this story already.
No, go ahead.
But I was a deputy head of a school in North London, a secondary school. And I got all in, as you do when you start doing mindfulness, I got all evangelical about it. And I thought, right, I'm going to teach all the kids some mindfulness. And I'd trained to teach.b by that stage. So I took all of year 10, possibly one of the worst year groups in terms of getting them on board with that kind of thing. They're very cynical. They're too cool for school. Mm-hmm. And I can honestly say that I think about 30% of them were engaging with the classes as I was running them. Yeah. The rest were, you know, texting under the table and gazing out the window and flicking things at each other. Mm. And I thought at the time, brilliant, 30%, I'm happy with that. So that was 120 girls. It was a girls' school.
Where
and,
was that?
In, North London.
Was it Margaret's? High school.
No, I'm not going to name the school. And okay, I'll tell you why in a minute.
No need to. I just, for some reason,
no,
it wasn't
Margaret's. Anyway, so fast forward 3 years later, I'm in my office. It's A-level season, and most of those girls are downstairs doing an A-level paper in English. Being a girls' school, we've got lots of them doing English. About 90 of them. Mm-hmm. And I get a phone call from the external invigilator, who doesn't know anything about what we've been doing in the school. Mm-hmm. And he says, Claire, you've got to come down here now. And I thought, oh, my God, what's happened? You know, and I went straight into panic mode and was thinking, oh, God, where's the mop? And how am I going to tell the parent? Catastrophizing left, right and center. So I went downstairs and I went into the exam hall. And the invigilator was there and he came over to me and he said, they're being really weird. And I looked at them and all of them were sitting at their desks. It was that moment where the paper was on the table, but closed. You couldn't open it.
Yes.
And they were sitting at the desk, feet on floor, hands on laps, head slightly bowed, eyes closed, every single one of them. And I thought initially, you're having a laugh. Mm. And I went around looking to see if I could see anybody giggling and just kind of thinking, well, they're all just being silly. But they weren't. And so I said to the invigilator, you know, start the exam. Mm-hmm. And he did. And they opened their eyes, they took a deep breath, I could see them all doing it, and then they calmly opened their paper and off they went. Mm-hmm. So in terms of an example of, first of all, not assuming that because they're not sitting silently and beautifully in your mindfulness lessons, they're not taking it in. Mm-hmm. And secondly, when they need it, they use it. Yeah. And in terms of exam stress, it's really powerful.
Yes.
Because they can, often stress is kicked in before we've even noticed it happening. And by that stage, it's kind of too late to really do very much at all. Yeah. But if you start to, one of the things we do with our lessons is we get them to read their stress signature. So how do I personally know what stress feels like in my body?
Yes.
What do I know are the habits of my mind as I get stressed? And then once you've become familiar with that, you can notice it when it's kicking in. And then you can do a practice that helps kind of calm things down a little bit. And that's when your thinking part of your mind can work more effectively. Doesn't, you know, that whole thing about the amygdala firing off when you're stressed and your prefrontal cortex shuts down, which isn't helpful in an exam situation.
Well, not in the exam situation, but trying to revise, right?
Yeah.
I remember being, you know, in secondary school, GCSEs, it's like 12 subjects, textbooks, you know, huge, thick. And Just the daunting nature of trying to pick it up and just trying to revise and to memorize. Usually I would talk myself out of it.
Yeah, that's right.
And so when you're panicking and you're stressed and it's like, how am I going to do this? Then again, you're kicking off that, you know, amygdala.
And that feeling of overwhelm, you know, just kind of feeling like the whole thing is so incredibly huge. There's no point in even starting it. And that's really common, really common. Not least because there's so much pressure on these events.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%. And again, because Daniel Goleman, you know, author of Emotional Intelligence, 25 years, New York Times bestseller, you know, actually says in his book that in his research, he found that mindfulness did have a positive impact on exam results.
We just
need more of the science and the research now to justify that, because I mean, when you guys are going for your funding or you're going to try and, you know, to different schools to try and get these teaching methods implemented. You know, if you had the argument that said, you know, this could actually positively impact results. Because remember Anne, who was a co-host with me last time, you know, a math teacher, him said, you know, knows all too well the, you know, when it's Ofsted time and when it's time, you know, and how a teacher is judged and how will they do. It's a big part of it comes to, well, how high are your student scores? You know, how well are they doing in exams? Right.
That's absolutely the focus. And again, the impact on the staff when that Ofsted inspection is happening, or even the threat of an Ofsted inspection. Notice the stress response then.
Incredible.
And it's, you know, I'm going to get political, but the fact is the exam system in this country and in many others as well is so outcome focused. It's so about grades and numbers. And it's almost as if we all the joy has gone out of teaching because of it. You know, you've got to work really hard to get a sense of joy when you're teaching, because the kids are also outcome focused. In the times when you're there having, you know, teaching a topic you love and you want to communicate it and it's why you went into teaching, and then, you know, and you're getting excited and maybe go off on a slight tangent about something or something kind of currently happening in the real world, very quickly a hand will go up and go, is this on the syllabus, sir? Or is this on the syllabus, miss?
Yeah.
And it's almost as if they can't see outside that box of, you know, this is what I need to know for the exam. And it's not their fault. It's the system's fault.
Which is detrimental to both teachers and students, right?
Yeah,
it's a lose-lose.
And, you know, and it's frustrating because education is about, well, if you take the root word of education, educare, the Latin, depending on who you are, most people will say it's kind of means pulling out, drawing out. So it's not plonking knowledge on an individual and saying, now reproduce that in an exam situation. It's what do you understand from this and how can we learn from this, and hearing their ideas, you know.
Yes.
And that's what's so rich about mindfulness, is that you're constantly your experience is your experience, and people want to hear what you've got to say, and that's how you engage students, and that's how you get them to learn. Anyway, sorry, getting all political about education system.
Beautifully said. Yeah, so we spoke of the, you know, 99.5% teachers would recommend it.
Yeah.
One of the statements to a friend or a colleague. So obviously resonating very well.
Yeah.
So what was the feedback, you know, as to why that's the case? And, you know, what is it that you guys are doing that's working so well?
The questions that we ask after we've trained people, and the feedback that we're trying to get all the time from the people we've trained over the years, is usually the quality of the materials that they've got to work with. You know, we've really spent a lot of time creating these materials and researching them and trialing them. And their hands are really held. We've got very kind of detailed teacher notebooks, and when they come and train with us, we don't just go, this is how you teach the lesson, but let's teach you a little bit about what it's like to lead a practice. What is it like to engage in inquiry? Mm-hmm. They get a chance to really discuss in groups what they're doing. So they love the materials. They love the fact that their own practice deepens when they come on these courses. They're quite long. Mm. You know, if you want to teach our primary curriculum, it's 3 days. And that's having already done your kind of introduction to mindfulness 8-week course, either with us or someone else. And the secondary school, and it's 4 days. But those days are really rich. And then they get into the classroom. They can hit the ground running the next day if they want to. They leave the training just having everything they need. And there's flexibility, because when you're working with different groups, obviously they all have different needs and interests. So there's lots of scope for you to do things slightly differently. You know, you leave out some sections. There's a core curriculum that you've got to teach, but then if you've got a quiet group, there are sort of worksheets you can do with them. Or if you've got a really engaged group, there's all the practical stuff you can do with them. There's a lot of humour as well, and lots of fun. And that's the general feedback.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say is like the next kind of 5-year goal? And, you know,
apart from reaching a million minds.
Yes. Apart from, yeah, a million minds.
Yeah, a million minds. Work at the moment involves trying to get reach across all age groups, all young people. So we're working on our early years curriculum, which is very exciting, and 30 sessions to do with little ones. we're also working on it's called a school development pathway, which holds the hands of schools right from first principles. We're interested in doing a bit of mindfulness. What do we do? Progressing all the way through to becoming what we'd call a hub school. So kind of a gold standard, good example of where it's embedded right across the school day and through the school week. So we're developing that, and then that comes with lots of resources to help people. So, you know, if they want to do an assembly on it, they'll have a PowerPoint and script for assemblies, and, you know, sort of putting them in contact with other people and connecting with schools that are like them and that kind of thing. And just, you know, adapting, constantly adapting. The world of mindfulness is, you know, about 2,600 years old, and yet at the same time it's changing all the time. Mm-hmm. So we're listening to the needs of schools. And if they're saying to us, we need a shorter course or we need something we can do in one day, we're trying to meet that need as well.
Yeah.
So just rolling with it.
Right. And if I'm, you know, teacher, student, parent, and I want to find out, you know, how to get involved.
Yeah.
You know, what would you recommend?
Get in touch with us. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't want to kind of dive straight in and do any of our courses or training, we're also acting as an advisory body, and we're really happy to kind of throw ideas around with you or connect you with someone else who might be able to help you with what you need to do. You know, we're answering thousands of inquiries every week, and we're really happy to kind of support people no matter where they are on their journey, really.
Yeah.
But just have a go, but have a go in such a way that, you know, it's kind of good quality what you're experiencing. So that's where we can really advise, you know, things that we know work really well, people we know who will provide you with something really good quality, mm-hmm. really good examples of other places that are doing something similar. It's all about just quality, integrity, and sustainability, really.
Right. And, you know, the website, mindfulnessinschools.org.
Yeah. Not to be confused with lots of other names of organizations that have mindfulness in them, but mindfulnessinschools.org, or if you just Google MISP, mm-hmm. that should come up. And you can also, if you Google that and on YouTube, you'll get a couple of our animations and guided practices to try.
Yeah.
There's a couple of free ones there.
Okay. Well, again, thank you so much for doing this. And I remember when we first spoke, you know, you gave us a couple of analogies of the puppies in the pen, and, you know, as they one meanders off and you just gently guide them back. You know, that stayed with me to this day, you know, like 6 years later.
Great.
And now that I have, yeah, since that first time we spoke, I have two children.
Yeah. You know, are they practicing? You got them practicing it? You're 5-month-old?
Yeah. Well, they're seeing Baba do it.
Yeah.
You know, they're seeing me. So I haven't tried to enforce it, but, you know, sometimes my son will just sit on my cushion and he goes, look, Baba, and he'll close his eyes and just try and mimic me.
Oh, that's so sweet. There's a wonderful school up in Liverpool that's among many, actually, who's running sessions for parents. So the parents come in towards the end of the school day, like half an hour before the end of school day. They have a little bit of mindfulness. Then their kids come out, and it's like unleashing, you know, energy, the likes of which you've never seen before. But then very quickly, the kids kind of sit, and they all practice together. It's really lovely. So lots of lying down practices where the parent will lie on their back and the child will lie on top of them and actually kind of mirror the breathing. And it's so lovely, but without kind of saying you must now sit down and do your practice.
Yes.
So I think it's lovely that, you know, I think it's really important that your 4-year-old sees you practicing and might join in at some point.
Yeah. I mean, not that he doesn't have a choice, but, you know, that question, you know, what would you tell your younger self? You know, so these are absolutely things I would tell my son, and you know, just to understand how it's helped me as far as happiness and life satisfaction and compassion, just in all areas.
It's just
making this journey so much, you know, so fun. So
and
for an organization like that, Mindfulness in Schools project, that, you know, we talk about the future are the children, and so really to embed it at a young age where it's not just the dot B, but the pause B, and just like that, you know, from as early on in the education
earliest
process.
Possible.
Yes.
It's become, like you say, it kind of titrates. It becomes part of who they are, and it becomes part of their day rather than it's something they're doing once a week. I think that's the big shift.
Yeah.
How do we do that? How do we bring that
and
about?
Planting those seeds, like
planting those seeds.
Yeah, watering even if they them. Don't. Yes.
Yeah. Watering them when you can.
Yes. Yes.
And yeah, just seeing what emerges, but never giving up, you know, and definitely as someone, either a parent or a teacher of mindfulness, never assuming that it's not there, that yeah. it's not landing just mm-hmm. because they're sitting beautifully with their eyes closed.
Yeah.
It looks different with young people.
Yes.
And you never know when it's going to show up, but it's there. And, you know, I keep saying it, but once you've learned it, you can't unlearn it. You can get better at it through practicing, but mm-hmm. but you can't unlearn this stuff. That's why it's so important.
Yeah, but for those that haven't learned it, it's like, you know, when you're, if you are facing challenges and things are difficult,
yeah,
you know, maybe this is an area that you should look into, because it's, you know, it's certainly working for many other people. The science says so, and it's, yeah.
Yeah, and also, you know, not just difficulty, but, you know, we work with kind of themes around gratitude and the good stuff, you know, noticing the good stuff, understanding how quickly we tend to ignore it, and actually choosing to turn your attention towards it can really make a difference to your day.
Yeah. What I loved is when you spoke about one of the benefits was the improvement in relationships between teacher student, which I think is huge. You know, if you've got a teacher that's really? Your mentor and your guide throughout the year, or maybe like 5 years. I had one teacher at secondary that, you know, for maths for 5 years was the same one, and it's like how important it was to have a good relationship.
Yeah, it's all about relationships. Mm-hmm. It's all about relationships. And also what's really wonderful, it's something that we're very much building into the school development pathways, is the change that happens when the young people start to own the practice, and in fact start to teach the adults around them how to do it. Yeah. You know, not least the neuroscience. You know, they love telling their parents and their teachers about the neuroscience, but also, you know, starting to lead practices. We had a little girl who came and spoke at our conference back in 2018 when we had Jon Kabat-Zinn there. Mm-hmm. And in front of about 800 people, and including Jon Kabat-Zinn and some other very important people, she led them all. She was 7 years old. She led them all in a mindfulness practice. Beautiful. It was magic. That's what they need to be doing, is kind of teaching each other and teaching their parents and teaching their adults. And how brilliant it is as a parent to have your child go, you know what, I can see that your amygdala is kicking off a bit right now. Let me just show you what you can do about that. Magic stuff.
Well, that's a great way to end the podcast. And again, Claire, as always, thank you so much for doing this. And
pleasure. Lovely to talk to you.
You know, I'll do the edits. We'll get it up on the website. And
cool.
You know, can't thank you enough.
Lovely. Really nice to talk to you.
And remember, if you would like to help create a kinder and happier world, please get involved with Action for Happiness. You can join thousands of others who are spreading a bit more happiness in their homes, workplaces, schools, and local communities. Our website has all the information you need to sign up for our Exploring What Matters course, and also details about facilitating one yourself. All the information is online, and we're here to answer any questions you have. Don't forget to subscribe, like, and keep up to date with all our content. Find out more at actionforhappiness.org. Join the movement, be the change.